Welcome to the True Falls Film Festival.
I loved the fabric of their voices. Like, you really hear the place in their voice. You hear, like, oh, they're from southeastern Illinois. You hear the history and the location and sort of the era that they're from. Mm-hmm. So there's all these different valences of how language narrates the past.
This is the True False Podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeld. Voice is an inextricable part of storytelling. The sound and textures of a voice can determine how an audience understands a story. In this episode, 2016 True False programmer Pamela Cohn talks about the power of voice with Deborah Stratman, the director of The Illinois Parables. The film is a series of vignettes that cover technological breakthroughs, exodus, and history. In this episode, you'll hear clips from the film throughout the conversation. Here's Pamela.
In the film, when you're playing with voice, it's very interesting to me, and then juxtaposing it into the sound that surrounds those voices and how you embed those voices of mm-hmm. the powerless and the powerful, mm-hmm. even when you're narrating those stories, like your narrators are also taking a stance. Can you talk a little bit about how you might direct this kind of voice work and how you might just mm-hmm. maybe you can think of an example, or we can actually play this Murfreesboro segment first and use that as sort of a launching point to talk about how you contextualize all of this in and embed it in the sounds that you use.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, we can play the clip first.
And, okay.
Yep.
They sent us down after we could get out to a little store down there on the corner. The roof was off of that place. And the people in there were just crying and carrying on. Well, a kid, I don't believe, realizes exactly what happened. And I didn't. I remember some big fella, come and grabbed I and my sister and says, I'll take you home. Well, we lived on around the curb there, and there wasn't two sticks for our house left. When we got there, it was gone. My granddaddy, he was watching the storm, see, from the back porch. And when he seen that big funnel, well, he hollered for my mother and grandmother and little baby sister to get in the cellar. They had dug a cellar where they kept their vegetables and stuff, and they just barely got in that cellar when that happened, hit. And I can remember the streaks of lightning that was going across the skies, and it looked like the whole town of Murfreesboro was on fire. Just lit up the whole town, and it used dynamite. Well, I can remember that. Oh, that was terrible, how that whole town was burning.
I was buried, and I think I must have been out for a few seconds or something like that. And my eye was resting on the corner of a brick. And then, of course, I was all covered, and my mouth was pried open. And the sand and gravel and everything was trickling down into my mouth. And I thought, oh, my, I'm going to choke. Then close by, I heard this girl praying. Oh, she was praying. And I can't tell you how many minutes we were buried. This seemed a long time, but they were walking on us, you know.
We were among the homeless. We had no home, no place to spend the night. And when my father went out to where our home was, he found our parrot. Her cage was flattened, and she was out of the cage, as black as a crow, standing up on some of the rubble, singing, "Sweet hour of prayer, sweet hour of prayer." And my dad wrapped some clothing around her and picked her up, and we kept her for many years.
That's a wonderful segment.
So the way that narration happens in the film is really varied, just like there's a lot of different styles that occur in the film, from reenactment to quotation to using found footage. And the same thing goes for the voices. So in this sample we're hearing people who are elderly who are remembering the Murfreesboro tornado that happened in 1925. And they had a VHS tape, or two actually, that was just person after person who was still living in Murfreesboro came. And there was, and this, I don't know when it happened, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, someone just sort of recorded all their stories.
Wow.
So it's just, it's not recordings that I made, but I loved the fabric of their voices. Like, you really hear the place in their voice. You hear, like, oh, they're from southeastern Illinois. I mean, it feels so, you hear the history and the location and sort of the era that they're from. It speaks just as much as what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to have that texture in the film alongside earlier, you know, you've heard other people reading. So mm-hmm. there's all these different valences of how language narrates the past. But I didn't want to limit it just to language or something semantic that narrates the past, but also to the way that sight, you know, the way a mound, for instance. There's a lot of mounds that come up in the film. There's right. like Indian mounds, and there's mounds by contemporary sculptors, and there's arsenal mounds, or there's the sort of scoured path that the tornado has left, or the Trail of Tears, and sort of how that's literally a path. So I feel like those marks on the landscape are narrative as well, but they don't lean on language. They lean on traces that are left in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so the film, because it's really a historical film, I wanted more than just one way that histories could be embedded. So as much as there's a certain history embedded in the texture of the one guy's voice who's talking about, you know, or the sand and gravel trickling down into my mouth, a woman, or the parrot who's black and singing the song. I mean, those, they give a richness to the sonic texture just on the different, even just within language. And then obviously to that, I like to add music at times or ambient sound. And just each of those builds a site, builds a place, builds a connection to the past. Because the images very often are fairly static in this film. Mm-hmm. And it really leans on the sound a lot to give to make the universe of sort of what you're considering at any given moment.
Coming up, we'll talk to Deborah about the voice behind a disembodied narrator.
I wanted the, like when it's brought up, the frustration of the people who lived in and around Nauvoo, and it was when the Mormons started voting as a bloc that the threat sort of started to rise about, oh, like, wait a minute, these people are going to have a voice here.
This is the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofelt. In this episode, we sat down with Deborah Stratman, director of the Illinois Parables, which played a True False in 2016. We're speaking with Deborah about how voice emerges in a film where there's no narrator, no main character, and no central figure. The commonalities in these parables is place and the stories that arise from it. How does the place speak? Which voices does a filmmaker choose to amplify? True False 2016 programmer Pamela Cohn spoke with Deborah about the editorial decisions behind this assemblage.
In terms of, we'll talk a little bit first, we'll play a clip after this, mm-hmm. but a very particular one about this notion of Exodus. But what's really interesting to me is how, in a way, in our culture, grappling with faith and grappling with technology, and then all of a sudden they conflate somehow. And there are certain moments in your film where we kind of see that, like, rather obliquely in a way, just because we're talking about natural disaster. And a lot of times I think for certain populations of people, those are acts of God. You know, they're the way you're playing with this faith, belief, disbelief, you know, running away from something, running towards something, all of these patterns that are emerging. Can you just talk a little bit about sort of like the spiritual base that you're trying to tap into that's mm-hmm. so part and parcel of who we are as Americans?
Yeah, not just who we are as Americans, I think who we are as humans, that that there's always an unknown, and what's the system that we've used to sort of bridge the gap or reach towards that unknown. And so that's where belief comes from. And so for me and for a lot of people, I think there's been a shift for some of us in who in whatever culture yours happens to be, where the where it's a more secular kind of reaching. So maybe the reaching is towards technology or physics or whatever it may be to bridge the gap between what we know and what we don't know. But the reaching is always there. I mean, it was, I guess to bring it back to the Americana that you brought up in your first question, it is certain because it was a reason so many people ended up coming to the U.S. in the first place, mm-hmm. as they were sort of being persecuted for whatever reason for their belief system where they were from. And so there was just, you know, a huge number of utopian communities and sort of religious outposts set up in the U.S. just because people weren't going to be accepted where they were from. And so the way that – I mean, the film is nothing if not full of oblique angles, because I feel like the way that sits next to stories where like the one that you mentioned where a tornado passes through, and when there's that kind of – erasure mm-hmm. of one's connections and one's past and one's self, then there is a reaching, and often it's like through to whatever higher power you want to reach towards, because you're kind of left with nothing else. I mean, when the connections to self, which are the objects and the things that make up, you know, your identity get mm-hmm. erased, you don't have anywhere else to reach. And so I feel like there was something about combining that with the advent of technologies that became sublime almost with the advent of, you know, sort of the power of nuclear bombs, or with the critical mass equation somehow. Once we sort of started to be able to wrangle forces that were godlike or sort of weather-like or much bigger than an individual could be, then I think that sort of, I'm getting a little bit off track, but I feel like, how do we say this? That
no, I mean, it's interesting for me. This is kind of leading to this way in which we've sort of imbued ourselves with godlike powers, right? If you sort of figure out mathematically, you know, biochemically or otherwise in these laboratories, you know, and you have this very evocative scene where, you know, this formula is being written out on a blackboard with this just sort of very tactile sound to it. It's almost mm-hmm. like gunfire in a way, you know, mm-hmm. it's just kind of this, you know, it does have this kind of quality of triumph in a way. I want to play a clip right now, the first clip that comes about 20 minutes into the film about this exodus. So there's this liminal space where, you know, they're leaving a bad situation, they're walking into the unknown. So I think this is the is it parable 4 with the Mormons? Let's play that clip and take a listen.
Nauvoo was founded as a refuge. Before the people came here, they had been driven out of Ohio, out of Kirtland, Ohio. They had moved to Missouri, but an extermination order was issued. So when they came with customs, accents, beliefs, and this aroused an intense curiosity. But then they began to vote in a block. That was a political problem. That began to take the custom political power of the old settlers of Hancock County away from them, and that aroused more than just curiosity, that aroused anger. The old settlers here called this an absurd religion. They did not share the beliefs that the Mormons had. So on a trumped-up charge of riot, he was ordered to come to Carthage County Seat to answer those charges. When they got him over there, they added a charge of treason. And then 150 men came in, charged the jail, threw the guards aside, rushed inside, and shot him and his brother to death. They marched 10 miles. On the way, they blackened their faces with gunpowder to disguise their identity. 9 men were put on trial for that, found not guilty. immediately, what began going on is their homes were being burned. Over 110 homes were absolutely burned to the ground. This was in the United States here. Across the river, it was no longer the United States proper. It was a matter of being driven out of their own country.
They had been driven from everywhere they'd ever been. From the very beginning, every place they settled, they were driven out, violently driven out. And this was just to go as far away as they could to finally get left alone.
So things never change.
Exactly. I was just going to say, what a achingly familiar story that we're like seeing. It's like a cross stitch, you know, all over the globe at the moment. And there is this reverberation in a way of these quote unquote historical moments that are being recontextualized in a very like they're being, you know, nested right in a certain way, one sort of residing by the side of the other. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about this structure of the parables. What is a parable? I mean, how are you defining, but beyond story, like how are you defining parable? Because it's also, of course, got biblical connotations as well.
I mean, for me, it was a way to have a story that had a real specific and local history. So that the fact that it happened in Illinois is relevant, that it sort of has seeped into the ground where it occurred, but also that it could function totally allegorically, that the stories are, that they take meaning from the specifics of the site where they happened and the people who were involved and maybe couldn't have happened anywhere else and at the same time could be anywhere else, could stand in for, you know, Syrian migrants, you know, ending up in Europe or refugees from, you know, Lost Boys ending up in North Dakota or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, and I was hoping that each story, not just on an ethical or moral level, but also on a political level. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, the parables, it's important that they feel equally, they have an ethic to them that's around spirituality or belief or sort of tolerance, but equally so around a kind of political outrage or but the outrage is never in your face. It's oblique, as you brought up that word before. I wanted the like when it's brought up, the frustration of the people who lived in and around Nauvoo, and it was when the Mormons started voting as a bloc that the threat sort of started to rise about, oh, like, wait a minute, these people are going to have a voice here. And it's again and again what happens when, you know, folks have to relocate and their background and their, you know, desires and their organizing starts to threaten the people who are from that place. And so often, especially because the, in this political climate right now, the way that, and it's always been the case in this country, I think, the way that faith and politics are intertwined and where intolerance in one field can really quickly sort of lean over to the other. So what is originally maybe just like a threat of around voting rights or something, or who's going to be in office next, becomes one that's, about religious outrage or sort of condemnation and hate speech that's really...
Yeah, virulent.
Virulent, yes. Yeah. I mean, my God, just turn on the TV or the radio any day of the week.
And well, this power of, I guess... you know, these lexicons that are built around political language and the way, I mean, they're pretty brilliant people, right, who, like, write this stuff. They know what they're doing. And the rhythms also are sort of like, or the delivery, I guess I should say, is really encouraged to be as much of a sermon or, like, pulpit, you know, from the pulpit kind of speaking to sway, you know, great swaths of the population that are confused, lost, feeling like whatever they're holding on to is very tentative.
Yeah.
And that it could be swept away. And if this person, you know, is in charge, we're all going to be fine. And it never ceases to amaze me, actually, how our baseline naivete just like never quite lifts off.
After the break, we'll hear another clip from the film and talk about how Stratman balanced voices with music and ambient sounds in The Illinois Parables.
It's not an insistence on, like, right now you should feel sad, or now you should feel ebullient, or because music is so facile at pushing us to feel emotion.
Hey, listeners, it's Allison. There's still time to check out Elemental, True False's reimagining of an escape room. Part puzzle, part art installation, Elemental is a no-words, no-numbers adventure about the building blocks of matter. Sounds mysterious? Might be. Check it out. For more information, visit truefalse.org. This is the True False podcast presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofelt. Let's go back to the conversation between True False 2016 programmer Pamela Cohn and the Illinois Parables director, Deborah Stratman.
In the music choices you make, I mean, for me, that's where I sort of, that's where the grief and the anger and the, those really sort of base emotions of, that aren't nuanced at all can really play out. Can just talk a little bit about your connection, your personal connection to music, and when you're looking at footage and thinking of those choices that you might make, mm-hmm. or things you've heard where you think, I don't know what that is, but it makes my heart swell, and mm-hmm. I want to use that someday in a film.
Yeah. I mean, music is tricky for me. I feel like it's so easy for music to sort of bury the traces of what you've built up in the image, that for me, I like to use it in more of a counterpoint way, or I like to deploy the music where maybe you've been given a series of scenes that intellectually kind of build up. You're like, okay, this was a sort of intense history that happened, but mm-hmm. I haven't yet given you or provided a space for the affect of that, for the emotion of that. What we hear connect, you know, maybe it's happening a minute or 5 minutes or 30 seconds after an image or a sequence that sort of propagated potentially a certain emotion.
Mm-hmm.
But it allows you to keep looping back and projecting forward and weaving something that's that feels less compulsively directed by me, I guess, that it gives you the space to sort of mm-hmm. have an outlet if you need it, but it's not an insistence on, like, right now you should feel sad, or now you should feel ebullient, or because music is so facile at pushing us to feel emotion, and maybe it's why I'm often sort of cautious about using
mm-hmm.
it, and this film uses it much more than
right.
some other recent films, but I'm wary of it because it's so powerful.
And then in terms of choices of that music and of those other sounds, I want to go back to this way in which, you know, we were talking about the distillation and also sort of the restraint of music. There's also a lot of anger, you know, there, mm-hmm. Just kind of like sitting there, meaning to be dealt with by the viewer. We'll segue into this Black Panther segment because that also, too, is very interesting and also somewhat predictable. But then you, again, like you're doing something that lays on top of that where that rage can sit there, be recognized, but yet still not somehow explode. You know, it's mm-hmm. like this kind of sustained tension
mm-hmm.
In the narrative and the way in which that voice is there telling you something as a matter of course, almost like testimony that is very mm-hmm. dry and removed and for the record, quote unquote. So I'd like to play this last segment of the Black Panther and we'll talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
As soon as Sergeant Daniel Groth and Officer James Davis, who are leading our men, announced their office, occupants of the apartment attacked them with shotgun fire.
There was no response from the group. There was no verbal response.
The response from the group was the firing of a shotgun blast at our police officers.
There was no verbal response in addition to that.
The response to our police officers was the firing at them by a person in the apartment.
Sir, you say your men were fired upon. Witnesses who have seen the apartment say there is no evidence of bullets from the direction where the Panthers supposedly were to be.
The account that we made public yesterday gives a detailed explanation of what happened in that apartment. I stand wholeheartedly behind it as absolutely accurate.
There is one inconsistency in, well, for example...
I do not intend to quibble about that account.
Do you intend to get at the truth?
The account that we gave of the events is the truth. I am taking the word of our policemen over what we understand is supposed to be a version provided by defense attorneys and by the occupants of the apartment. Of course I don't plan to resign.
Mr. Henry, have you been at the scene yourself?
No, I have not been at the scene.
Okay. What you're seeing in this section is, or for a good part of it, is my reenactment of us. It's a re-reenactment, in fact, because the state's attorney's office, Edward Hanrahan's office, after the police and FBI as part of COINTELPRO had gone in and raided Fred Hampton's apartment, they wanted to give their version of the story, which would have been that, you know, they were fired upon by mm-hmm. people in the apartment. Mm-hmm. And so in order to create their version of the truth, in the state's attorney's office, they created a set which looked sort of similar to what I built, just 2x4s, black floor with all the furniture taped out on the floor. And all the officers who had been involved in the raid reenacted this in the state's attorney's office, and it was broadcast that night on the evening news as news. And this just blew me away mm-hmm. that this A would have, that they would have been, it's kind of a brilliant move. Like, well, let's just reenact it and call it what happened because that's how history gets made.
Of course.
You know, what gets broadcast and what gets talked about and what gets shown and mm-hmm. what gets told is sort of the record. As with anything historical, it's our responsibility to keep questioning how it's written and to keep, if we don't rewrite it, at least to keep, you know, returning over and over and over again, I think, to what has been sort of written into record. And so I thought, all right, I'm going to re-reenact what they did. The ritual of re-reenacting what they had done, it is a kind of, it's a very specific choreography.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a specific rewriting of memory. But then I wanted to sort of paste back on that. Later you hear some of Fred Hampton's speeches and some of the Panthers telling, but over the same gestures, over the same, not exactly the same shots, but the men doing the same gestures. So to take back in a way, or at least to provide another read to the footage. The one scene that's still emotional to me, well, there's two that are still emotional to me besides the fact that I've, you know, seen it a bajillion times over many years now. And I think it has something to do with that accruing of anger and maybe not disbelief, but a sort of remembering these sights. And at the end, when the hot air balloon kind of takes off the ground and you're suddenly weightless, there's this sort of recognition of the emotional traffic that you've been through mm-hmm. that still moves me, which is always a good sign. I feel like, okay, if I can watch something a bajillion times and still
right.
feel like it's a release, and that's
mm-hmm.
good.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
You're
this
welcome.
Was a great
Thank
conversation,
you.
As always.
Thank you, Pamela.
Thank you.
Deborah Stratman is a Chicago-based artist and filmmaker. Her most recent film, The Illinois Parables, premiered at Sundance in 2016 and has won awards from the LA Film Critics Association, Ann Arbor Film Festival, and Filmmaker Festival in Milan, and many others. To listen to more of our podcasts, go to kbia.org or download them on iTunes. This episode was produced by Todd Chen and edited by Bram Sable-Smith and Ryan Van Mulliner. Our music was created by Tim Pilcher using sounds of the True False Film Fest. Special thanks to Callie Luna, Haley Godburn, and Danielle Hogarty. I'm Allison Kofelt. Thanks for listening.